This week on Retronauts.
I haven't had this much fun since the last time.
Hello, everybody. This is Bob Mackey, your host for Retronauts episode 26 Pocket, and today's topic is Planescape Torment. Before I go into any more detail about this, let's introduce who is on the show today. Who do we have on Skype? We actually have two Skypers. Let's go with the guy whose name begins with a J.
Oh, that's me, the recently deceased Jeremy Parrish.
Oh my God, what happened?
I thought this episode was about dying a lot.
It is, but you took it way too seriously.
Oh,
I think.
Damn it.
Yeah. RIP Jeremy. Who else is on Skype?
This is Gary Butterfield, and luckily there's very little consequence for death.
Yes. In Retronauts, you can die over and over again. It doesn't matter. And Gary has been with us a few times before. He was on the Sega Genesis Portland Live Show, and he was also on our Out of This World episode. So yeah, welcome, Gary. Thanks for joining us.
I'm very happy to be here.
Who else is here as normal?
I'm Ray Barnholt, and I'm fit as a fiddle.
Ray, that was a world-weary grunt.
I had to take a second to figure out who you're talking to.
Oh, okay.
It's like, I had to take stock of the room and realize, oh, it's just you and me.
Yeah, that's it. We're here. It's nice and cozy in the studio. But
I apologize.
That's okay. Today's episode is a backer episode, and this one comes from David Pascal, and I'll let you know what he says in 1 second. So David says, Planescape Torment was what originally made me think that video game stories could be anything more than terrible. The combat was at best mediocre, many possible character builds locked you out of the best parts of the game, and a lot of the writing tended towards overly wordy philosophizing. But despite these fairly major shortcomings, the game was a cohesive whole in a way that few games since have matched. The characters that you met during the game were interesting, and you were actively rewarded for exploring their depths through dialogue. The atmosphere was built brilliantly from the moment you first awakened in the mortuary, and the game reacted to your choices in a way that made the story feel much less linear than it actually was. All these factors combine to make the game one of my absolute favorites. With the recent rise of the importance of storytelling in games and the current development of a spiritual successor, it seemed like a good time to have you talk about one of the major touchstones in Western RPG design. And that is from David Pascal. So thanks a lot, David, for supporting this episode, and hopefully they'll be worth your money. Okay, so today's episode is about Planescape Torment, and just a word of warning, it's a big, meaty game that I did not have time to play all the way through. I played a lot of it, but Gary is here as our expert on Planescape Torment because his podcast, Watch Out for Fireballs, did a two-part episode about it, which comes highly recommended, but you know, if you don't want to spoil yourself, you might want to play through while the podcast is going. Not at the same time, mind you. It's not that long of a podcast.
Well, and so, you have to read a lot during
that is true.
Tournament.
Yeah.
It's not a podcast game.
Yeah, my brain doesn't work that way. I don't think anyone's really does. But if you consider this the Planescape 101, Gary's podcast, Watch Out for Fireballs, is like the advanced Planescape version of this discussion. Yeah. So please check that out. I recommend it highly. And so let's get into Planescape Torment. So what is it? Well, it's an Infinity Engine game released by Interplay for the PC, developed by Black Isle, and it came out in late 99, actually December 99, almost a year after Baldur's Gate. But this game is much better looking than Baldur's Gate, at least from my experience. The characters are much bigger, the animations are better, things are much more distinct, and that's important for a game where it's a very surrealist landscape with very horrible, ugly things in it. This game was led by Chris Avalone, who's been on Gary's podcast a number of times, and he's a legendary game developer. And once you hear what he's worked on, he's essentially worked on every important Western RPG of note, or most of them, actually, from the 90s onwards. So we have like Fallout 2, Icewind Dale, KOTOR 2, Fallout New Vegas, and so on. Like, he is the RPG master. And what do you have to say about Chris Avalone, Gary? I know you're a big fan of his stuff.
Yeah, he's one of my favorite game creators, and there's a real through line, in the stuff that he does, where it is respecting player choice and emphasizing that as a mechanical and thematic thing is really important to him. And I think it shows in all of the stuff he does. You mentioned one of the things you didn't mention was Alpha Protocol.
Oh, right,
which is, yeah. One of the few games I feel does kind of moral gray areas almost as well as Planescape.
That's very true. And in our last episode, we talked about RPG battle systems, and I feel like this is my own theory, but you can feel free to correct me at any point. I feel like where Japanese RPGs went in a direction that focused on mechanics and numbers and battles and systems and things like that, I think Western RPGs focus much heavier on storytelling and, you know, in these gray areas of morality, especially Planescape. Do you guys agree with that take on the different split in RPGs at all?
Yeah, I certainly do. Yeah. I mean, it seems obvious even when you just look at the back of a box of like a great Western RPG.
Yeah.
And it's just like, yeah, wow, this is really taken seriously, its whole world and everything.
Because like, go ahead, Ray.
I mean, yeah, it's not really so much about blowing things out with some new slick-ass battle system or something.
Right,
I mean,
yeah.
You know.
I mean, like Baldur's Gate, the battles in that, it's like, you know, stand next to the enemy and click on them, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of planning that goes into it, but the actual way the battles play out, where it's basically all the math is hidden from you, and you're basically just given the results of that math, like in Dungeons & Dragons. Mm-hmm. But battles are not a big deal in Planescape, so let me explain a little bit more about what Planescape is, the setting. It's like it's a D&D campaign setting, and like any D&D campaign setting, it's really complicated. If this was a D&D podcast, we could probably do like 15 episodes about the Planescape setting itself. But just in a nutshell, it was created to restore the cosmological aspect of Dungeons & Dragons without necessarily mentioning angels and demons, which was a little bit of a sticking point for some groups, the whole devil connection with Dungeons & Dragons. So, you know, Planescape is basically just a bunch of different dimensions that are interconnected through portals with just a very, very surrealist, like, atmosphere. It kind of reminds me of the Sandman comics. Gary,
yeah.
Jeremy, any thoughts on this? I don't know a lot about Dungeons & Dragons, unfortunately.
Yeah, what I kind of get from Planescape, the setting, was that it is a successful attempt at making a world where just about anything is possible and having those things live next to each other and make a sense.
Okay.
It's not just a cosmology in the world of you know, angels and demons, but also you know, clockwork representations of law and you know, people made out of salt and things like that. It's you know, there's kind of that thrust where everything exists next to each other, and then this really strong idea that belief is power, which plays out in Torment quite a bit. And just this idea, if you were in a universe where if someone believes in something enough, it is true, what would that look like and how would that function as a city? And it's a big, messy, you know, kind of clockwork, you know, like you mentioned, intentionally kind of off-putting and hostile looking.
Right, but, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like there's a sort of intangible, almost impossible to describe quality about Planescape, the setting, where I can only make comparisons like it's like Sandman. It's like where Beetlejuice lives, basically, just like weird sandworms and creatures and things of all sorts of, I don't know, just like the really creative ideas that go to great lengths to justify themselves. So you talk about like the salt people world. I'm sure there's an entire mythology about them. The mechanics of how their existence works is written down somewhere, you know.
Well, and that's written in the splat book here you can buy.
So yeah, exactly.
You know, if you want to get the expansion for Saltland.
Yeah. Saltland. Wow. That's a pre-order bonus.
The pepper seas.
Yeah. So what is this game about? Well, you start out as a character called the Nameless One, who is an immortal who has lived many lives but can't remember any of them. And, you know, the premise of the RPG hero with amnesia is probably the most tired idea in the universe. Even games like Phoenix Wright will give the character amnesia occasionally to be like, we need to reintroduce you to these mechanics, so you lost your memory.
I mean, he's the Nameless One, but can you input your own name?
I don't think so.
Interesting that you bring that up. You can't, but there's a really interesting detail. And one of the things I want to mention about this game is how amazing some of the details are. If you lie and say your name is Adon enough times, you will meet Adon. It will create Adon in the world. So if you need a cover story for a name, it eventually will make it true.
That's incredible. Yeah, this game does lots of really incredible things, but we'll go into a little bit of that in a bit because I just want to set up the premise because it's important to understand what this is. So yeah, you play an immortal and with amnesia, which it serves the game mechanics because A, the game needs to go to great lengths to explain to you where you are and what's happening in the world around you, and there's a ton of world building because like nothing in this world is like what is in our world. Like things have so many different meanings. The way people live is different. The way people work and live amongst each other is different. So there's a lot of great lengths taken to explain that to you. But also dying is not an issue either in this world because you are an immortal. And when you die, I believe the only thing that happens to you is you are just teleported back to the mortuary slab that you wake up on. Is that correct, Gary?
That is correct.
Okay, but there's no like stat penalties or anything like that?
No, there's nothing like that.
Okay. And like I said, this game runs on the Infinity Engine, and it looks a lot better than Baldur's Gate, which came just a year before. And I think they were just taking advantage of, like, this will be one of the last 2D RPGs we can make, so we need to make the most of this engine. Because I believe, like, he would do Neverwinter Nights shortly after this, and that was all polygonal, Chris Avellone, and Black Isle as well. So, like I said, it's an Infinity Engine game, but I played Baldur's Gate for this podcast, and I didn't play it in the past. And I can go into a little bit more of that more as to why, but it's much more intuitive than Baldur's Gate. Like right clicking will bring up this helpful radial menu, which is like just a major way to make the game more playable. It makes interacting with the world much more intuitive. And one thing to know about this game is that it's incredibly ugly, but in a very intentional way. Like on the cover art, I like to call him Zombie Lenny Kravitz because it's just this blue guy with dreadlocks on the cover, like giving you a really really pissed off look, and everything in the game is just hideous. I mean, like, there's only so much disgusting quality of the world that this game can render in its low resolution, but, like, it goes to great lengths, again, with descriptions. Like, you are told horrifying things that you can barely make out in the tiny pre-rendered sprites, but everyone is scarred up and dripping with pus and ooze, bleeding, their parts are falling off, things like that. So that's essentially the premise of Planescape Torment. It's a happy-go-lucky world where anything can happen and usually does.
It starts off a little bit closer to that, and you do get to see some kind of different worlds where there's a little bit more variety in the people and a little bit less straight-up Fangoria nonsense.
Yeah.
In a world where people like the undead are a resource to be used as kind of slaves, like there are a lot of people you run into who are having that kind of problems, but a lot of it is more surreal, like somebody who has no features on their face, opposed to actually being gory. It's much more about being off-putting in a way, and Beetlejuice is kind of an amazing comparison, actually.
Oh, thank you.
To that, like, that's actually very, like, you could step into the world of the sandworms or the civil service office of the dead.
Yeah, you basically wake up in the waiting room of Beetlejuice in this game.
Yeah.
Essentially. Yeah. But yeah, like I said, this is a Dungeons & Dragons game, but the role-playing, at least in terms of pure numbers, isn't as important as you would think. You roll a character in the beginning, but essentially, as from what I've heard, like, your mental stats are much more important because combat in this game, it's not very good, and it's not always an answer to every problem as it would be in a lot of other RPGs. So you end up talking your way out of a lot of problems, talking your way into certain situations, and just really communication is key in this game to really achieving anything, because at most it's a quest for knowledge. Like, you're just trying to figure out who you are, who you've been, and like what your life was like or your lives were like in this incredibly strange world.
Right, and that's it ties into when you mentioned the amnesiac protagonist. Unlike many games, it serves the game perfectly, because that is the goal of the game. When people kind of rag on the combat of Torment, it's not, it's not the point. And when you get a little bit further in the game, you realize the real enemies and the real threats are not necessarily things you can punch.
Yeah,
So finding out, gaining that knowledge, finding out about yourself is rewarded mechanically as well as, just getting more story, which is oftentimes what happens in video games. Like, it's actually saying, hey, this is what you're going to get a better experience reward for talking your way out of a fight than fighting.
Right.
Like, and at every point, the game is pushing you towards that.
When you start the game, too, like, they kind of make a point to let you know, like, don't fight everything that's hostile because there are better ways to do things. So it's even reinforced within the game itself, like, with tutorial stuff in a way. Like, there are better things to do in this game than fight, because the fighting is basically standing next to a guy until he dies, essentially. But I think it's, like, there's not a lot of nuance to combat, but in this game, you're basically, like, swinging a rotting corpse's arm at an enemy, or, like, the weapons are not very, don't have a lot of flair to them. They're just very rudimentary, like a rusty scalpel or like a zombie's arm or like a hammer. You're not like getting like the ultimate sword of blessed wisdom plus five, you know.
The interesting thing is like you do, but a lot of that stuff was on purpose to kind of subvert, you know, what saw as like, you know, fantasy mechanics. Like there are only three swords in the game and they're really intense major things. And other than that, it's, you know, work hooks and you know, rotted arms. But a lot of the kind of flashy stuff comes in the spells. Like the game has, it was the first time I'd seen a Western RPG that has kind of Final Fantasy style cutscenes for spells. Some of the later spells go, you know, straight up at Final Fantasy VII, One Winged Angel. You know, you get to see a little movie that shows what's going on when you summon Plane of Law canon.
Yeah, I didn't reach any of the magic yet, but I know like early on you're given like a number of roles that you can take, like a mage or a thief or a warrior. But really, like, you know, magic is key in this game to surviving and to like solving problems. From what I've read and from what I've heard from your podcast, Gary.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about how it's you know, it's D&D, but not really. I mean, you have your stats, your wisdom, charisma, intelligence, dexterity, etc. You have, like, your weapons are measured in, like, how many dice rolls of power is this and things like that. But I think the main D&D quality to this game is the way it tells you the story. It's told very much from, like, a dungeon mastery perspective where you talk to a person, you go over and click on the person, and it will give you, like, a description of what they look like, what they're doing. And when you go through dialogue with the people, they will pause and take actions and, you know... It's very much in like a very third person omniscient narrator kind of storytelling kind of way, which I appreciate because, you know, Dungeons and Dragons is ostensibly about storytelling. It's not just about rolling dice over and over again. And I did really appreciate that as far, you know, thinking about how Western RPGs really embrace story more than mechanics. This is definitely a huge example of that.
Yeah, and that intersection between the two, like giving you a mechanical imperative to pursue the story.
Right, right. And it's weird because, like, at this point in history, console RPGs and PC RPGs were incredibly different, and I was, like, directly in the Final Fantasy camp. you know, like, I'm playing Final Fantasy VIII. That's when this game came out. FF8 was out. I could not care about Infinity Engines or anything like that. And I feel like I really missed out on some experiences that I'm only catching up with now because, like, this game is much different than I thought it would be. I thought it would be very, like, micromanagey, Baldur's Gate-style RPG, but essentially it's an adventure game with some light RPG elements. I mean, you can approach it in many different ways, but the way I was playing it was, like, sort of, like, dialogue trees, you know, looking for items, things like that. Not your standard RPG stuff, at least Japanese RPG stuff.
Yeah, you know, I feel like that's such a big thing about Dungeons & Dragons, you know, the original thing is that, you know, it's to me it's not so much a game as it is just, like, group storytelling.
Yeah, I mean...
And, you know, the thing with all these games that are based off D&D stuff so heavily is that, you know, it's sort of functionally like a D&D novel, you know, because the storytelling is already there and you're just like... It feels like most of the time the designers just can't do much except, you know, plug in all this dialogue and story and stuff to make it seem as... deep and dynamic as you know a D&D campaign with your friends,
mm-hmm.
and so you know I'm not saying that's a bad thing necessarily because you know I like RPGs of all kinds, but it's just like it's one of those things that really differentiates that whole pen and paper world from you know the video game world. It's just so much more about storytelling and just making up your own stuff as it goes along, and having a campaign that can go on you know for a decade or more if you want to. With the same characters.
Right. I mean, there's a podcast out now that a bunch of comedians basically play Dungeons & Dragons, and very little of it is rolling dice. It's all about storytelling, making up zany, crazy adventures with your friends. And this is not zany or crazy, but it is quite an adventure. And in fact, we're talking about just in terms of the sheer text it's using to communicate this story. I read that it had 800,000 words in the final version of the game. That's a lot of words. And I find that the game has the freedom to use like relatively unsophisticated means like text to communicate a story, but it does so much more effectively than it would have with graphics, and also much more affordably. You know, it's telling you these things about you meet this person, it gives you a description of their face. The game doesn't need to render their face. That description is in your mind, and it's a great way to go about doing things. And I think Gary even called it like a visual novel, which, I mean, it doesn't look like a visual novel, but the way it tells its story is very similar to one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just a couple of things I want to touch on. What you had said, Ray, there's definitely, a continuum of that, of games that are more successful at adapting that side of the Dungeons & Dragons experience versus just the kind of dice rolling section. Because the closest thing to, you know, the dice rolling kind of tactical tabletop experience. It would almost be something like a tactical game like Final Fantasy Tactics, just to say Tactics over and over and over, where, you know, you have a certain number of movement points, you have a certain percentage of chance to hit somebody. That is like almost a pure expression of that side of it. Yeah. But this game does such a good job of actually making an interactive story where the way you're kind of comporting yourself, really matters. And you do have that sense of agency and interactivity with the world.
Yeah.
Minimizing that whole taking actions part of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's such a wide kind of swath of that, because Baldur's Gate does that all right. And I think that you're possibly a little bit hard on the Baldur's Gate combat. Like, it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, I didn't give it enough time, to be honest. And I know you're a huge fan of Infinity Engine games. I'm just a Philistine. I'm approaching this from that angle, Gary.
It's funny, because when I play, I'm in both camps. I love Final Fantasy, and I was playing Final Fantasy VIII at the same time I was playing this.
Oh, wow.
But oftentimes my characters were just facing each other, hitting each other too. Yeah, you know, I had a similar experience to that. Hmm. Yeah,
and another thing Planescape did is they have, like, okay, so last generation of consoles, the big thing was morality systems. Like, hey, guys, you can be good or bad in our game. We're changing the way you think about goodness and badness. But, you know, secretly, the bad guy might be good and the good guy might be bad. Don't tell anybody.
Yeah.
morality's complicated.
Then at the end, he's bad.
In the end, it turns out we're all bad and we shouldn't have bought that game in the first place. But, morality systems. Planescape does it extremely well. I didn't have enough experience with the game to sort of see how it paid off, but... Gary, you talked about, you just recently did, or recently as in when you recorded your episode, you did a pure evil run. And like classic D&D, it has alignment systems. So depending on your actions, you can fall into one of the, what, 8 or 9 alignments in D&D?
Yeah, 9.
Oh, there's 9, okay. And it's not like you're going to choose like the explicitly good or the explicitly bad option. In these cases, there are a lot of gray areas, some of which you don't realize the effect of until much later in the game. Gary, can you talk about any of the morality systems in play in Planescape?
Yeah, absolutely. Because one of the things that this game did that its predecessors didn't do, you know, being good or evil in Baldur's Gate, is just I'm going to save the kid and not ask for a reward, or I'm going to ask for a reward. And those are the two, those are your options. And in this game, they really wanted to make it, you know, what if there is a situation instead of a good path and a bad path? What if there are two good paths? You know, what if there are two bad paths and you just have to choose which one you think will do the least harm? There's a lot of times, or what if you know, everything is mixed. It is the truth isn't in the middle. The truth is on both sides. You know, every time there's an antagonistic relationship set up, both sides have a strong argument and kind of an ideological backbone, and you can choose which one you agree with more, because it's much more about that choice than actually explicitly doing good or doing evil.
Yeah.
And that ties into this kind of faction system where, you know, people rally around beliefs in the game. It's just very elegant the way that gray morality is a exoskeleton for the whole thing.
Especially when you're given a universe where the rules are so much different than the rules in our universe, where it's like... In some cases, it might be okay to accept like slavery is an okay thing if it's an undead zombie that's carrying around your goods or whatever. If you want to take that approach, I mean, I don't believe that way, but it's just like, oh no, slavery works in this context. Please don't take that clip and use it anywhere, people.
To use an example to, you know, make that make sense and make Bob sound less like a monster.
I love slavery, but only with zombies.
Yeah. Is that, you know, you in the game, you can sell your body into slavery after you die, and people do this to feed their families now. So do you put an end to that? You know, is that ultimately a good thing or a bad thing? Is it right to take that choice away from them because they're going to be a slave for eternity? They made the choice. You know, nothing is really quite as black and white as it is in kind of lesser games.
Yeah, like even in the beginning, you confront these zombies and you try to talk to them, but they won't even respond to you. So it's like, is there a consciousness even hidden in this corpse, or is it just like an animated pile of flesh that is just built or like engineered to serve one task at a time? It just, the rules are so different than our rules in our world. You really have to reexamine these situations and understand like what is going on in terms of morality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to mention something real quick to loop back. When you talked about using text rather than speech and being able to do a lot more, I love the way that this game does a little bit of both, where you'll often get a little bit of speech for an important character, so you get that characterization through that. Like, oh, this is someone who's gruff, this is someone who's sly, but then the majority of their dialogue is not not in speech. So they can say a lot more. And it means that the unimportant characters, because I can read a lot faster than I can listen. So if I play something like a Dragon Age, every villager who has their life story to tell me, if it's not that interesting, it just takes longer for me to get through it.
Yeah, yeah. You know? And that was a concern. Go ahead.
I was just going to say it becomes wearying, you know, as you go. I like this kind of old spiderweb software, BioWare Infinity Engine approach, where I can zip through something at my own pace rather than being kind of passive and movie, you know, cinematic-like.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I voiced these thoughts on the voice acting episode, but I feel like voice acting is not always necessary, like you said. And it's someone who enjoys reading, it was fun to be like, I'm just reading this game. I'm being told so much, but I'm never being interrupted by, I'm not being interrupted by a voice actor who's like five lines behind what I'm reading. You know, it's not like there's that trap you fall into where it's like, oh, I lost my place because this guy won't shut up. thankfully, a lot of games let you silence the speech. But in this game, they use it very well. Like in the beginning, Mort says a few things to you. He's your floating skull companion, which I love. He's a cool guy. He looks like he belongs on a GeoCities webpage floating above your guest book banner or whatever.
Voiced by Rob banner. Paulson.
Voiced by Yakko Warner and other characters. Yeah. And I believe he was probably in Baldur's Gate, too. They use a lot of top-tier voice talent then. Those big Interplay bucks, right, guys?
Yes, exactly. Those are the days.
Yeah. So, Jeremy, you haven't really added too much, and you probably were as familiar with this game as I was before I went into it. Can you talk about Planescape in any way? Like, what's your experience with the game, and how do you feel about it?
My experience with the game is that I've spent the past 15 years fuming that it's not available to play on Macintosh.
That's right, yeah.
I have bought a copy of the game. I own a copy of the game, but it's unusable for me because it doesn't run on my platform, and no one's ever created like a good old games type shell to make it work on Mac. So it's been kind of frustrating because, you know, everyone has talked about what a great game it is. Guys like, you know, Nick Maragos, who is a localizer now at Atlus, so clearly he knows something about good writing in video games, has said it's the best written video game ever. So it's something I'd really like to play, but I just don't have the means to do it, and it's disappointing. So I didn't really do much reading on the game before this podcast because I don't want to spoil it for myself. I'm in this like weird zone where there's like this 15-year-old game, and you know, like the statute of limitations on spoilers is long over. I can't be resentful if someone spoils it for me, but. You know, like, I don't want to watch, like, Let's Plays of it because I would like to experience this game for myself someday.
Yeah. I should mention, though, if you have a PC or a PC-friendly Mac environment, I guess, it's on Good Old Games for $9.99, which is well worth the price. If you don't want to play it, there's a really great Let's Play of it on the Let's Play Archive that's written in, a third-person kind of thing, sort of, like, in the style of the game itself. I didn't read too much of that, so I'm not sure how well it's written, but from the little I've seen of it, I really liked it. So if you don't want to play through the game, and I recommend that you do, there's the Let's Play as well. But like really, I was surprised by this game because Baldur's Gate, I enjoyed it like on a theoretical level when I was playing it for the podcast we did about it, but it kind of turned me off in some ways because I just am so used to playing Japanese RPGs, and there are so many things that they streamline, although, you know, they don't tell stories as well as Western RPGs. But in this case, like I said, I played it as an adventure game. It was it wasn't what I expected it would be, and because of that, I enjoyed it a lot. I mean, even the combat, for as much people complain about it, it just seemed extremely simple to me. I don't know, Gary, like, what do you think about the combat in this game?
It gets a real bad rap that's mostly deserved, and I think that what people are reacting to is that it's not the game's strength. So the game presents this world where you can talk your way out of situations and you can sneak into areas and you can gain favor with a faction that can smuggle you in somewhere or disguise yourself, things like that. And then there are a couple of choke points in the game where combat is the only option. So it's not so much that the combat itself is that much worse than a lot of RPGs of its time. It's worse than Baldur's Gate, but it's not abysmal. It's just that the game hasn't been emphasizing that, and you've been kind of led to believe that it's going to be something you're going to opt into rather than be forced into. So it feels bad when it comes up.
That's what I've heard. I mean, like, you can play the game a certain way, but at certain points you'll be forced to, you know, deal with a set of circumstances that you're not prepared for, regardless of how you play the game. But what I liked about it was that, like, Baldur's Gate, I'm not trashing Baldur's Gate, I'm just comparing as to their different approaches. I respect what Baldur's Gate does, just so you guys know. But I like Planescape better because you start with only two characters, so there's much less micromanaging to take care of with those characters. And then your party can grow up to what, I think like 5 characters. But I like starting small because like the world of Baldur's Gate was not one I was equipped to handle like with that many party members immediately. I was losing track of people. I was like getting characters confused with each other and things like that. But I really like how they start small. It feels like a much more console friendly, it was never a console game, but like a much less complex, at least initially, game. It feels more approachable, even though the world and everything is just so ugly and hideous and repellent. It feels a lot easier to get into than other Black Isle RPGs, at least from that era.
Yeah, the companions you have, you also, you know, they tie into the main plot much more so. So they're much more compelling than any of the Baldur's Gate companions. And there's a reason they're there.
Yeah.
You know, so they become part of the main quest. Part of the idea of the game is finding out their backstories. And it's rewarded, you know, with this wonderful story, rewarded mechanically, and it's the initial kind of thrust of the game as well. So they're more manageable, there are fewer of them, and there's a better reason for them to be there.
Hmm. Yeah, I just I don't know, like I do plan on going back to this game. I unfortunately never have time to play like outside of work RPGs, which is why I've been playing Bravely Default like SimCity for the past 5 months. My town is awesome, but my characters are level 1. But at some point in my life I do want to go through this because it just it's so compelling. I was immediately hooked by the story. Like sometimes world building annoys me because it feels like the writers are always more interested in making up new words and using them as often as possible than they are in making something interesting and like that will hook the reader.
Yeah.
But in this case, the world was complex and they kept describing it to me, but I wanted to know more. Like I want to know who the Dustmen are. I want to know like, you know, what the purposes of the undead and like what they're doing in this world and like how their currency and things like that. Like it presents a really compelling mystery, and I think games, they rarely do that. Present a mystery that's worth pursuing to the end, and that's why I do want to play through this game to the end, because like, who is this guy? Like, where did he come from? How does he fit into this world? All these things are not apparent from the beginning of the game.
I think you'll be pleasantly surprised by how literary the answers to those things are. I mean, you know, making the comparison between games and books or games and other media is always kind of a trap, right? Because one, they're different things, and that's a good thing. You know, we should celebrate what makes games games. You know, we don't need games to be movies. We have movies.
Yeah.
But also, it's rare a game, I think, that actually does kind of have that complexity that a well-written novel does. And this game is, it's very, you know, complex and thematically rich. Like the answer to those questions aren't, it's one of those things, because we make the comparison to JRPGs, and I love JRPGs. Again, I'm not, you know, bagging on them any more than you're bagging on Baldur's Gate.
Right.
But I'm always unsatisfied when the end boss ends up being somebody I've never heard of, kind of comes into the last act. Like the Final Fantasy last disc thing, I think, is atrocious. Yeah. It's such a bad idea storytelling-wise. And this does something that is so satisfying with that I've never seen it before. Like, I think that you will be very, very pleasantly surprised.
Now I want to play it as soon as I get home.
I want you to play it so bad.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah, I might just chip away at it steadily across the next couple months. But I mean, there's not much more to say. Like I said, this is basically an introduction to Planescape. I really wish I would have had like the 20 or 25 hours it takes to plow through it. But I did get a really good taste of it, and I want to go back. And Gary's sort of like our expert on this episode. So like, if you want to hear more about Planescape, obviously play it and listen to Gary's Watch Out for Fireballs episodes about that. You can just go to, I think, duckfeed.tv, and they're on the page. I think that's about as complex as it gets in terms of finding a podcast. But yeah, so before we go, I just have one question to throw out. What can modern RPGs take from Planescape? And I think they can take a lot, because Planescape had the benefit of being able to work with resources that weren't expensive, like text and pre-rendered graphics. I mean, pre-rendered graphics, say what you want about them, but the fact that it communicates almost everything through the text is the reason why it can be so complex. Like we talked about earlier, other systems are tied down by voice acting and things like that, and the need to create resources for everything that happens, and animations too, like things like that. Like a really cute thing in Planescape was you can disguise yourself as one of the Dustmen, who are these cloaked characters, and they only use knives. But if you equip a weapon, you'll still have that weapon equipped. It will only show you the knife in the animation. And they point that out in the character description, like, hey, you know, this character will only be wielding a knife, but you'll actually be using your real weapon. And I thought that was cute. They didn't make a new animation for every weapon possible with the Dustman costume. They just have an attack animation, but they go out of their way to tell you that there's a reason why that's happening. Yeah. And you know, in any other game, they would have to create animation. They would have to create something for every circumstance, at least in terms of visuals. So yeah, like I feel like it was working with a lot of things that other games are. It wasn't working with a lot of things that other games are now burdened with. So, but there's a sequel coming out. It was Kickstarted for $4 million, and so there's more on the way if you're interested in that. But in terms of what RPGs can learn, I don't know. I just want to see them go beyond the good and evil crap, because every time I see a game come out with that focus, I'm wondering, like, this idea is just so played out. Why are we still doing it? Like,
there's no reason to believe it.
Yeah. Like, I know what's going to happen at the end, regardless of what you're trying to do. So it's just like, I don't know. So that's what I want, you know, future RPGs to do. Like, let's think more about morality. Let's think more about, like, presenting compelling mystery that I'll want to follow, things like that. I don't know. Ray, how do you feel about, like, what modern RPGs can take from Planescape?
Yeah, I mean, I was just thinking about what you just said, about, like, the whole morality stuff. It's not worth believing anymore when they say any of that stuff.
It's essentially just like skill trees. Like, I want to be the good skill tree or the evil
effect,
skill tree.
Yeah, the Mass Effect thing where the planet's a different fucking color at the end of the game. Thanks, assholes.
Wow.
I mean, you know, just like, it's like, go big or go home.
Yeah.
You know, really. Yeah. I don't know how else to put it. Really.
Yeah. That's true. Like, I do feel like the morality thing is much more a mechanical thing than it is something that reflects narrative now. Like in Infamous or whatever, you get the good powers or the evil powers, and it feels the same with everything you do. Gary, can you talk more about, like, morality or what you want to see people take from Planescape? I'm just interested from your perspective.
Yeah, I agree with you for sure. I think there are a couple of games that do that and do it all right, and they are always flawed in some poisonous way that scares people. You know, like Alpha Protocol or like Vampire Bloodlines. Those games do what you're talking about really well. Yeah. It's just they have these broken systems that are hard to get around. One of the things, so I don't repeat your answer, that I would love to see, and Fallout 2 does this really well. It's kind of a Avalon thing. But I love being rewarded with, you know, do you think I could do this? And then having the answer be yes and have something neat happen. You know, little details like that, you know, if you say, make up a name early on, that person exists. This is a non-spoiler detail, but if you ever need to get back into the mortuary, you can pay someone to kill you.
I did see that early in the game.
You know, things, those little tiny details like, oh, should I try this? And if you do, you're rewarded by that. And there's so much of that in this game. You know, oh, if I learn this thing, I bet you this companion has something to say about that. They probably do. You run into a character later who doesn't speak your language, and you have two people who can translate for you, and they both translate in different ways, and one of them is trying to hide information from you. So you have to compare these two translations. Like, just a detail is what I want. Interesting detail is what I want more in games.
That's true. Like, even in the very beginning of the game, there are these, like, giant skeleton warriors who are relatively peaceful, I guess. So they don't aggro when you get near them. But if you have a book, you could, like, undo the runes on their armor and just destroy them. If you, like, compare the runes to the book and then undo the runes in a particular order, like, you put them to sleep, then you destroy their armor, then you destroy their being or whatever. I don't know. It's just, like, all these little puzzles within the dialogue system, which I love.
Yeah. I wanted to add to that is that the detail thing is really something that's not explored, especially in the Japanese RPGs, where it's like, oh, yeah, they'll write, you know, a tome's worth of crap about the world and all that, but it doesn't show up anywhere outside of, like, the game design document or the art book that you have to buy for $40. I mean, that's a good thing, too. It's just, like, have some detail in there, you know, really think about it, and just put it out there for people to find, and don't, you know, just don't leave it in the heads of the designers.
And one thing I should have pointed out earlier, that this is not a fantasy game. I mean, it's a Dungeons & Dragons game, but it's not like Swords and Dragons and stuff. And again, more RPGs need that kind of setting. It's hard to do, which is why there's only one Planescape now. But it's something that should be pursued, because I'm just sick of, you know, it's Dragon Age, it's Tales of, it's this, it's that. It's just like, oh, yes, I'm fighting the same things over and over with the same looking characters, wearing armor, shooting spells off, things like that. I want something different. Jeremy, what do you think, like, RPGs these days should take from or learn from Planescape Torment?
Yeah, I'm going to go with the morality thing like everyone else. Just the ambiguity that is so lacking in video games. You know, I guess there's The Walking Dead that kind of gets into that and makes you have hard choices to choose between. But it, you know, that's pretty much all the game is. I mean, it's a story without any real quote unquote gameplay. And that's fine. It's just you know, it's not really what you think of as an RPG. Yeah, I mean, we've harped on BioWare and they're really bad about that. And you know, even beyond that, like games that try to give you a complex or nuanced or morally questionable narrative, it tends to be kind of railroaded. Like Spec Ops: The Line, like, you know, that game is really notorious for making a statement against war, but there's only one path through that game. Nier, you know, it has the kind of infamous New Game Plus where you discovered that pretty much everything you did your first time through the game was completely horrible, but you had to do those things. Like, the game design did not give you any other options. The narrative didn't give you any other options. And, I mean, you know, it's fine if you want to tell a story, but you look at something like the BioShock games that make such a big deal about the morality of choice, and they don't give you any choice. I mean, the first game, BioShock, gave you the ability to kill the little sisters or not, but that was pretty much it. And even that was something that supposedly the publisher kind of shoehorned in there because Irrational didn't really want to do that. They just wanted to tell you their story. And again, it's fine, but it rings hollow after a while when you have all these games saying, oh, aren't you so bad for killing people? Oh, you're so terrible. You video game murderer. But that's how you design the game, buddy. So my choice is be moral and don't play your video game. Well, okay. If that's really the message you're trying to send me here.
Yeah, exactly.
The meta commentary is getting really tired.
Yeah, something more nuanced that, you know, along the lines of what Planescape did. I realize that's really hard to do because you have to design all these outcomes and figure out ways to make all these different things you can do mesh with one another. That's really hard, but you know, I feel like it's worth doing, and I'm okay with sacrificing things like voice acting. I mean, really the most complex morality we see in video games these days and in RPGs is from the Shin Megami Tensei series. And in a lot of cases, those games, you know, use very minimal voice work because they have to factor so much in and cram that into like a 3DS cart, which is really tough.
Yeah.
So that's my thought.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I'm glad we all love Planescape. It's a great game. You should all play it. And yeah, like I said, it took 800,000 words to create that kind of an experience. Not everyone has that ability to crank out all those words, but I'm glad that there's a sequel, and I'm glad that we've sort of divorced ourselves from the idea that when a game becomes technologically outdated, it means it's the end of that kind of a game. Like, because I'm sure we all thought when 2D games were going out of style, that was it. There would be no more 2D games. And I'm sure that people, when you know, isometric RPGs are going out of style, everyone thought, like, no, everything's going to be in polygons from now on. But there's a market for these kind of games. People appreciate them. And they're getting sequels through Kickstarter. Like, Wasteland is also getting a sequel. Is that out yet?
Pretty much.
Early access.
Early access.
The beta's out.
And does it look like Fallout at all?
A little bit. Like, okay. It looks a little bit like, you know, what Van Buren was going to look like with the original Fallout 3, just a little bit better looking, but same angles and on the action and such.
Very good.
So excited.
And I'm glad that this is happening because I feel like I need to correct the sins of my teenage youth and actually play these games. Now that they're new, now that they can be maybe a little more thoughtful about what new players would expect, I'm really looking forward to playing Planescape from the past and the new Planescape whenever that comes out. And I'm glad Retronauts opened my mind to these sorts of experiences. And mostly, I think it's our guest backers that helped out. So thanks a lot to our guest backer for this episode. I'm scrolling up to find his name. Okay. And it was David Pascal. So thanks a lot, David. I really appreciate your contribution. Hopefully this episode was up to your standards. So let's wrap things up real quick. As always, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, SoundCloud, Twitch.tv. As Retronauts, so bookmark all that stuff, add us to your feeds, and whatever happens on your cell phones or whatever you use to look at the internet. Also, go to our blog at retronauts.com. You'll find a track listing for the music we use in every episode. We also have links to relevant things that we talked about. And as always, keep the reviews coming. They always help the show. They make the show more prominent on the iTunes music store. And that gets us more listeners. And we can always use more listeners. So please give us a review if you haven't. It should only take you a few minutes. And remember how much we love you and how we're just human beings and we make mistakes. Right?
Please.
Yes. So contact
info. Planescape is my favorite Obsidian game.
Ooh.
I was just saying that to make a mistake, so people will yell at me about it.
It's my favorite JRPG.
Yeah.
So contact info, let me just tell you who I am. You can find me on Twitter as Bob Servo, B-O-B-S-E-R-V-O. And I also write for US Gamer and Something Awful, so check that out. Jeremy.
I'm on Twitter as GameSpite, where I say more than I did on this podcast. And I also write for US Gamer and assorted and sundry other websites.
How about you, Gary?
You can find me on Twitter at GaryBuh, G-A-R-Y-B-U-H. You can find my old games video game podcast, Watch Out for Fireballs, at duckfeed.tv. And if you are interested in the Infinity Engine, I just started a blog where I'm going through in painstaking detail through the games of that, starting with Baldur's Gate. It's called The Infinity Engineers, and you can also find that at duckfeed.tv.
Yes, and Watch Out for Fireballs comes highly recommended, and they might... No, you guys are doing a better job than us sometimes, so we need to keep the podcast Cold War going.
Yeah, yeah. And IU, we do very different things. We talked about that before.
That's true, yeah. We have very different approaches. Ray, where can we find you?
Why am I last? I'm in the room with you.
Because your name begins with an
I'm
R.
Right in front of you. Come on. No, fine. Yeah, all right. I'm RDBAAA on Twitter. Listen to my podcast, No More Whoppers, and, you know, just keep an eye on my Twitter. Sometimes I'll show you some cool things.
Secret Scroll News coming soon?
No, not secret.
Okay. Not Secret Scroll News. So, thank you for joining us, everyone. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. Until then, take it easy.